Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. I am very happy to welcome back the very lovely Debs, who is an independent midwife and came on a couple of seasons ago. Was it last season? I think it was last season.
I think it was
to talk about independent midwifery, and has very kindly agreed to come back to talk to us today about two things. One, which is nuchal cords, and the second is cord prolapse. I almost forgot what it was that I was going to be talking about. So welcome back. Lovely to see you. The reason that I reached out to you is because you do amazing posts on Instagram. I love every post that you write. And you do a fantastic post on nuchal cords, which I really wanted to do an episode on because I think it's something that is quite misunderstood. Do you want to first off talk about what nuchal cords are? Because we were just saying earlier, nobody calls them that, do they?
No, they don't. I guess we just talk about cords around necks a lot. And that sounds quite scary, a bit noose-like, and a bit, like it should spell disaster, basically. But essentially a nuchal cord. And actually, now you've caught me out, because I think a nuchal cord is just a cord around the neck, mm-hmm. whereas cords can go into all sorts of positions. So they can wrap themselves around bodies, shoulders, arms, legs occasionally, although that's relatively rare. And I actually don't think that you call those nuchal cords. I think nuchal is just around the neck. So I generally talk about corded babies. Mm-hmm. So babies that have got the cord wrapped around somewhere, one of their appendages, arm, leg, neck. So yeah, it's essentially a cord that has created a loop somewhere, and that loop has added itself to the baby in some way, shape or form. And that's what we're talking about. And I guess we can just, I mean, if we just stick with the term nuchal, it makes most sense for just talking about something without complicating it. But we're talking about all sorts of wrappages, I suppose.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to talk about it is because, I mean, I hear it all the time where people say, when I was born, the cord was wrapped around my neck. And that's why, you know, my mum had to have an emergency C-section, or thank God I was in hospital because the cord was wrapped around the baby's neck. And it gets perceived as this, you know, really dangerous, scary thing. And also, I think something that a lot of people worry about, and it puts them off having a home birth, for example, because they're worried about, because they've heard horror stories about cords round mm-hmm. necks. So how dangerous is a nuchal cord?
I mean, it's really interesting because for midwives, it's a total non-issue. And I think generally for obstetricians, even it's a non-issue, really. I know that there are some countries where, obstetricians are a bit more concerned about it, and they do try to scan for nuchal cords in the antenatal period. I mean, what are you going to do about it when you see one? There's really nothing that we can do. We can't unloop it. Research has shown pretty clearly that, you know, doing an elective section for a nuchal cord is really not appropriate. In this country, really, and I think actually also in most other countries, birth professionals are generally not concerned about nuchal cords because they're so common. About a third of babies are corded in some sort of way. And generally, it doesn't cause an issue. Most of the research is very reassuring about nuchal cords. Some of the research has even found that it's a sort of a reassuring feature. Theorizing, perhaps because If the cord is relatively long and loops itself around somewhere, then there's less cord floating around freely, ready to be compressed. It's sort of in a nice little safe, squidgy channel where not much compression, which is basically what we're concerned about. We're not concerned about strangling the baby because I guess that's what people imagine, isn't it? Strangling the baby. But babies don't breathe. So we can't really strangle a baby in utero as such. But I guess what might be a concern or could theoretically be a concern is cord compression, where the cord gets compressed to the point at which it doesn't transport blood effectively and efficiently anymore. And that's the thing that we as birth professionals maybe think about sometimes when we see certain features during a labor. But generally, we don't worry about nuchal cords because they're just common and they are a normal feature of a baby in utero.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Oh gosh, I don't know where I was going with that question. What was the question?
That's good.
I have a tendency to ramble, so.
What happens if you do identify a cord is wrapped around a baby as they're being born? What typically would you do about it?
I mean, generally nothing, because you don't need to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, you wouldn't even really see it until the baby is well and truly on the way out. So once the head is born, there's often enough sort of closeness to the perineum, and there's enough sort of folds in the skin that you might not even see if there was a cord around the neck.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the shoulders start to be born, at that point it's a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really matter, and I wouldn't really do anything. Occasionally or usually it makes sense to unwrap the cord before bringing the baby up to the birthing person's chest, just because it might not reach otherwise if there's still a cord around the baby's neck. Plus at that point the baby does want to start breathing, and therefore a tight cord around the neck might actually not feel great for this baby.
Mm-hmm.
Plus there might be a little bit of cord compression happening as well, and we want the cord to flow really nice and freely through the cord. But generally nothing. Occasionally and actually on that note, when I was trained to be a midwife, I was still taught to check for a nuchal cord when the head was born. And it would involve taking a finger and sort of poking it really close to the vulva and to see whether there was a cord hidden in the little neck folds of the baby.
Mm.
Presumably to do something about it. I can't even remember what I would have done if I had found one. I don't think anything particularly. But very, very shortly after I trained, that sort of fell out of fashion, thankfully, because it's very uncomfortable. And also fiddling about with a cord may actually make it spasm and may reduce cord flow through the blood flow through the cord. So we don't do that anymore. Occasionally a cord can be really tight once the baby is born. Or once the baby's head is born, and occasionally it might look like it is so tight that it doesn't let more of the baby be born. So the shoulders might be sort of pulled towards the perineum with the cord. And when that happens, we've got something called the somersault maneuver, where we basically assist the baby's head to point towards or to move towards one of the birthing person's thighs, and then the baby's body can be born past the baby's head. This is quite difficult to visualize, but if you Google the somersault maneuver, then there's some really nice illustrations and videos online that show what I mean by that, and that's super effective. In the olden days, and actually occasionally it still happens now, but it really, really should not. I think that was also mostly in the days when we did check for nuchal cords. We used to cut the cord before the baby's body was born, which of course can be absolutely disastrous if the baby's body is not born swiftly.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not necessarily disastrous, but very detrimental, even if the baby's body is then born swiftly, because we've deprived the baby of a lot of its own blood that it needs to transition well into extrauterine life, and generally transition well, you know, when it's being born. But we don't do that anymore, mostly. It does still happen. I do know of a case where it happened recently, and then there was a shoulder dystocia, and that had disastrous consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really not something that's appropriate in practice anymore. And yeah, but generally, in the vast majority of cases, the baby is born, the cord gets untangled, and the baby is grand.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's generally the extent of action that is required.
It makes me wonder why it's perceived as such an emergency, and where that perception has come from. And what do you think? Why do you think that there's this kind of societal belief that a cord wrapped around a baby's neck is such an emergency?
I mean, I think there's several points. I think A, we love a bit of drama, generally.
Yeah.
And also we like to assign meaning to situations. So I think sometimes if a baby maybe did not transition well after birth, or, you know, there was some compromise when laboring and there was some heart rate abnormalities or, you know, something. And then the baby's born and the cord was around the neck, then it's really easy to say, ah, look, that's why. And maybe occasionally, you know, that was why. And great that we recognized that and we could act on it. But generally, it probably is not necessarily the one reason as to why whatever happened. So we like to assign meaning, I think. But also, what is the case is if there was any degree of cord compression during labor, or particularly during the expulsive phase, when maybe the cord is getting compressed against the pelvic bones, particularly if it was cording the baby. What happens is when it gets compressed while the baby is still in utero, so there's three vessels in the cord. There's two arteries and one vein. The vein is sort of very thick and a little bit floppier than the little arteries. The arteries are thinner and more muscular. And the vein, contrary to what generally happens in the body, the vein brings newly oxygenated blood back to the baby from the placenta. And then two little stronger arteries push deoxygenated blood back to the placenta to be reoxygenated, to come back through the vein to the baby. But when there's compression, that vein that is thicker and floppier gets compressed easily,
mm-hmm.
whereas the arteries, they continue to function relatively unimpeded. So that means that the blood that the baby has used is being shunted back to the placenta to be reoxygenated. However, because the vein has been compressed, the oxygenated blood has trouble coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So when you've had a baby that has had some cord compression for quite a while and is then born, they might look quite pale, floppy, shocked. They might even be unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And what that sometimes is due to is what we call hypovolemic shock. So they have got a lesser blood volume than they should do to be able to transition, to be able to perfuse all their organs, make their lungs work well. And so at that point, what would generally happen, you know, after birth, we see a baby that looks shocked and not a great color and quite floppy. Traditionally, we cut the cord and we take the baby to the resuscitation table. However, if you have a baby that has had cord compression and is affected by hypovolemia, so lesser blood volume than is appropriate, what they need is they need their blood back.
Yeah.
Desperately. And when they get their blood back, they often recover remarkably quickly and well, because that was all that was, you know, in inverted commas, wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
So when we cut the cord to those babies, we leave them in this state of hypovolemia, which is obviously not great. However, if we leave the cord intact and maybe start transitioning and assisting this baby to the transition while the cord is intact, oftentimes, if compression hasn't been too severe, oftentimes the cord will refill and the baby will get its blood shunted back to it because mm-hmm. the vein can transport the blood again without compression. And so oftentimes what happens is what we call autoresuscitation. So the cord will automatically by itself help to resuscitate this baby. Mm-hmm. And that's a really, really great mechanism that oftentimes we completely miss out on when we cut the cord immediately when we see a baby that seems quite shocked.
Yeah.
I think oftentimes we see that scenario. And then again, we assign that meaning, you know, this baby is shocked because the cord was around the neck. And in those instances, it might be true. You know, there was too much compression, perhaps. Maybe not even from the cord around the neck, but because the cord was sort of higher up on the baby's body. And then when the baby was born or the head was born, there was compression as it got squeezed by the pelvic bones. And so in that case, it's sort of true, but also we sabotage the whole situation by cutting the cord then early. So I think we've got those two things, wanting to assign meaning and also sabotaging things when the cord has caused a bit of an issue, which it can do. You know, it is possible. I think that's where that comes from, to be honest.
And I think that brings us quite nicely onto cord prolapse as well, because this is another situation that can occur during labor. And I suppose that's the emergency aspect for cord prolapse is the cord compression, right? Do you want to talk a little bit about what a cord prolapse is? Because I think it's something that, I mean, I'm aware of, and I know lots of birth workers are aware of cord prolapse, but a lot of pregnant people haven't heard of it before and don't know what it is.
So essentially cord prolapse is where the cord is exiting the uterus, sometimes vagina, before the presenting part is. So the presenting part is the part of the baby that is going through the pelvis first, basically. And that's usually a head, sometimes it's a bottom. Occasionally it's something else like an arm, but that's something, you know, a bit of an emergency in itself. So I'm not going to go into that. Because the cord ends up before or in front of the presenting part, it can become really very compressed. And it's one of those things that is a definite obstetric emergency that can and often does lead to the death of the baby.
Mm-hmm.
The direct cause of death or of distress in that case would be cord compression. Cord prolapse can come in very many different ways. It can either be very, very obvious, where a loop of cord is coming out of the vagina, and it's very obvious to everyone that that's what happened. Sometimes the cord can be out of the cervix and in front of the baby's head, but really not visible or even easily felt by anyone. But the birthing person might feel there's something in their vagina that feels a bit weird. And sometimes it can also just be at cervix level, but in front of the baby's head, with the baby's head exerting pressure on it, even possibly with intact membranes too. And that would be more called a cord presentation, but it's quite likely to then move towards a cord prolapse, I guess,
mm-hmm.
If waters go, for example, and there's more pressure on the cord. Very rare. I think the stats are about 0.1 to 0.5% of all births or something. It's a very, very, very unlikely scenario. It's very, very unlikely in a straightforward, normal birth. It's more likely if a baby is very, very tiny, premature, presenting in an unusual way. So if a bottom is down, if the baby is sideways, if the baby is oblique, it's much more likely then. It's more likely after obstetric intervention. So after artificial rupture of membranes, much more likely then to occur. You know, a bit more likely if the baby is in an unstable lie, so if it moves position a lot, if someone's had lots and lots of babies before and the baby's head is not in the pelvis well, if there's lots and lots of amniotic fluid, what we would call too much or polyhydramnios, then it's a little bit more likely as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more likely in specific situations and less likely if everything is completely normal and straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it can happen. And generally, it means that the baby needs to be born ASAP, as in right there and then if possible. And oftentimes that is via crash cesarean section, if in the hospital. If at home, it's a bit more tricky because obviously you need to get to the hospital. Occasionally, a cord prolapse can happen when birth is imminent and you're at home. In that scenario, you might just try to get the baby born as quickly as possible and call for help in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a tricky call to make as to when to transfer and when that needs to happen. But yeah, it's one of those emergencies that no one wishes to ever encounter, but it does sometimes happen. It can be managed.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always lead to the absolute most disastrous outcome. But there is a chance that it might, and it's a fairly good chance. And I would have to look at the incidence of cord prolapse and the rates of adverse outcomes from that. I haven't had a chance to do that. Do you want to talk about how it might be managed?
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. Yeah, because you know I know how it can be managed, and I think, you know, the aim of a lot of the stuff that I put out there is to educate people so that things don't happen in the moment and they had no clue what was going to happen, because I think that could be quite traumatic. So if you can cover, you know, what the steps would be and what would happen if you did have a cord prolapse, I think it would be good.
Yeah, I think recognizing it or suddenly realizing that there is a cord prolapse can be very scary, because once it's recognized that it's happening, things need to happen really quickly. There really isn't a lot of time for nuanced discussions, and there just isn't at that point. If it's an acute cord prolapse, it really is a life and death thing, unfortunately. So I, for example, always cover it with my clients before birth. I just have a chat about all sorts of emergencies. If they want to, if they don't want to, then that's fine too. But most people do actually want to know a little bit about what might happen in the worst case scenarios, so that they are prepared. So essentially what needs to happen if there is a cord prolapse is for the pressure of the baby's presenting part to come off the cord as much as possible, so that the cord can continue to shunt blood to the baby effectively, or as well as possible in that scenario. And that we can try to do that in several different ways. So one is maternal position. So generally the birthing person would maybe go into position where the pressure of the head is not quite so much on the cervix anymore. And that's generally in all fours on the ground, with head on the ground and the bum in the air. And as undignified as that is, at that point, it's a good option to take. And that might also then involve the midwife's fingers trying to push the head off the cord, with consent, obviously. It might also involve filling the bladder, the birthing person's bladder, with saline solution, because the bladder also has the ability to push the head off the cord and to keep the head really nice and high in the pelvis so that there's less pressure. And then ambulance transfer wise, that's quite tricky, because ideally you'd want someone to transfer in the knee chest position, so head on the floor or the stretcher, bum in the air, so that there's a slope with the bum being the highest part. But the ambulance staff are generally not happy, and it's probably not very safe, to be fair, to be driving around like that, because you can't secure someone easily on a stretcher like that. So what we would generally do is we would suggest that someone goes into a side lying position, exaggerated, we call it exaggerated Sims position. So side lying, like a recovery position, but then with several pillows or wedges under the bottom, so that the bum is as high as possible, and the baby's head, again, you know, is not as close to the cervix as it was before. And, you know, we would pre-inform the labor ward of the local hospital to say that we are coming and please get theater ready, unless the baby is born in the meantime, which occasionally can happen. But generally, the safest thing probably would be a cesarean section. Again, you know, you would have to consent to that. But it is important to recognize that it really is a life and death thing in many instances. That would be the situation.
Yeah.
And usually the cesarean section would be under general. It would just be very quickly putting him to sleep and getting the baby out as quickly as possible. You know, very scary and rushed situation. But like I say, thankfully, incredibly rare.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Yeah. And then this is why I think it's good to have these discussions and to make, you know, pregnant people aware, because it's a consideration to make when thinking about, you know, so for example, medical interventions like induction, which, you know, there are certain methods of induction that may increase the chances of a cord prolapse, like having your waters broken, or like a balloon catheter, for example, which also increases the chances of cord prolapse. And I think knowing, for example, like you said, you know, if you do have an emergency C-section, that you're likely to be under general anaesthetic. I don't think that's something that most people plan for. You know, they'll do their birth preferences and they'll do their C-section preferences, and they'll be assuming that they're having a spinal or an epidural. So I think, you know, just being aware that it is a possibility for a general anaesthetic, and you know, putting some planning into that, I think, is a really important thing to do.
Definitely. I think especially if you are having a cesarean under general, which is, to be fair, very, very rare these days. But because you are asleep and you won't be able to have someone in theatre with you, it's really worth putting some thought into what you would happen with your baby at that point, and what you would like to happen in terms of breastfeeding and putting the baby to the breast for the first time and all those things. Having a tiny bit of thought towards that is possibly not a bad idea, depending on your circumstances, I guess. Mind you, I feel like we've talked a lot about really horrible emergencies right now, but
we have. But I guess, you know, as a hypnobirthing instructor, we talk about, you know, staying positive and talking about all the lovely, you know, positive aspects of birth. But I do feel like it's important to be informed about different emergency situations as well, because it can be really traumatic, particularly if it completely blindsides you and you didn't know this was a possibility, and you've put no planning in place, it can be quite a very negative thing. I'm not saying that just because you've got a plan in place is not going to be traumatic, but I think having some awareness of these situations, I do think, is helpful.
I've definitely met more people who were really grateful that they had discussed emergencies when they eventually had occurred, so that they had a bit of an idea of what was going on, what was likely to happen, understood what did happen when it happened, and it really was helpful in not making it necessarily a traumatic experience. And I've also met quite a lot of people who did have a traumatic experience when they absolutely had not wanted to consider anything might not go as planned with their birth. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, like you say, in birth preparation, we do talk a lot about I mean, I don't actually necessarily, but lots of people talk a lot about just, you know, putting it out there in the universe that you're going to have a really good positive birth, and you know, you reap what you sow, and all that stuff. And I think a positive mindset is very helpful to some extent. Mm-hmm. But it's also in many ways putting the head in the sand a little bit, particularly in the context of birthing in this cultural context, and birthing in this system of maternity or gestational care that we currently have,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, it is likely that you're going to have some sort of intervention or some sort of complication, yeah. or some sort of thing that makes your care providers want to put some sort of prophylactic measure in place,
mm-hmm.
That then in turn, you know, makes your labor more difficult or more complicated than it needs to be. And not all of us, you know, as hard as we might try, we don't have full control over that. You know, we can try as hard as we want, and we still don't have full control over what happens to us when we enter into the current maternity gestational care system. And we can't always be completely on our guard, particularly when laboring, because our head should not be in the being on guard space. It should be in, I'm laboring and I've surrendered to that and I'm just doing that space. So yeah, I think just thinking through and considering what might happen if, you know, anything happened that wasn't planned is a really good idea.
Yeah, I think so. I think, I think doing some prep, educating yourself, and I think you can do it in a more positive way. You know,
oh,
you
don't 100%, have to watch, yes.
You know, other people's traumatic experience unfold.
Don't do that. In order
to prepare yourself. You know, which is why I don't love, you know, watching things like One Born Every Minute as a way of antenatal prep. I don't think that's
I would never suggest that anyone do that, because that is that's not what I meant. But
yeah. No, but yeah, but I do think educating yourself in a balanced way, I think, is really important. One thing that I did want to mention, because it's something, it's an occurrence that's happened with clients of mine, and it's related to the cord prolapse, is having a transverse baby, because I guess the concern there is if baby is side lying, because that's what transverse means, then there's a chance that you could end up with a cord prolapse.
Yes.
And so what's your views on, you know, being asked to stay in hospital for 37 weeks? Because it's something that one of my clients was told. She was like, well, your baby's transverse, you're 37 weeks, we want you to come in. And then she was in hospital for weeks waiting to go into labor because they wanted her on labor ward in case she went into labor and there was a cord prolapse.
I think it's a very personal thing. The NICE guideline recommendation is to offer someone admission if the baby is unstable or in a transverse lie or oblique from 37 weeks. And to some people that makes sense, because they're very afraid that, you know, their waters might go and the cord might prolapse.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps they've had a labor start with ruptured membranes before and that really scares them. And, you know, after weighing up the pros and cons of all of that, they decide that that's what they might want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I've certainly had quite a lot of clients who, I've had clients who've decided to do that. But I've also had clients who have decided that actually to them, the risk was not large enough to warrant hospital admission. And when they've made that decision, we've just talked really nuanced about the way that maybe they would act if they did have a rupture of membranes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending, they might want to get into knee chest and call an ambulance and get themselves to the hospital as quickly as possible if they feel the baby was still transverse.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might not feel like they need to take those precautions, but that's what I would chat through with them. Certainly, if they had any signs and symptoms of cord prolapse, then, you know, we would talk through what the procedure would be for that and what they have to tell the paramedics. So, yeah, a very personal decision. You know, you don't have to if you don't want to. And for some people, it will make sense. And for some people, it just doesn't make sense. For some people, it's not practical. And it's just weighing up the pros and cons in your own head and your own, I guess it's about your own personal boundaries, risk appetite, blah, 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 you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Which
I think is the case with anything, right? With any,
absolutely.
You know, I think, and I think that's one thing that I really want people to understand is that there's always options, and you know, it's not my place or any other birth worker's place to tell a pregnant person what they should and shouldn't do, because like you said, risk appetite and assessment of the situation and own personal beliefs and preferences are different for every single person. And people go, oh my god, that's terrifying, absolutely, I'm going straight to hospital and I'm going to stay there from this point on. And other people will, you know, look at the statistics and all the research and go, actually, you know, on balance, I'm fine and I'm quite happy to not do that. But it's different for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing, isn't it, that there is always options. There might not be great options, but then you don't take the ones that are not so great. And sometimes you're between a rock and a hard place and you have to pick between two pretty crappy options. But there's always options. You know, one is always to do nothing. That might be a really daft option for most people. You know, in the case of cord prolapse, you do have the option to not do anything. I can't think of many people who would choose that, but it's an option. I think it's really important to recognize that even though the options are not always great options.
And you have to ask. Right, you have to ask what the options are, because sometimes you don't get given the options.
No,
if you don't know what they are, then you can't choose.
Yeah, or you might just be getting a very limited amount of options, because there's usually more than two as well. There might be a mix of several different options you can sort of cobble together for yourself to make an option that's acceptable to you. But you know, there's all sorts of things to consider as well, because if you do get admitted to the antenatal ward with a transverse or unstable eye baby, you're also going to be offered thromboprophylaxis. So, you know, they're going to assume that you're going to be less mobile. Therefore, they want to give you, you know, anti-clotting injections to mitigate for that. Even though you might be very mobile and walk around the hospital a lot, or at least the ward, you know, if you don't feel comfortable leaving the ward because you're too worried about, you know, your water's breaking. Interestingly, I've once had a client who did choose to be admitted, and then the one day where her friend was visiting and she went down to the canteen, her water's broke in the canteen.
Oh no.
And so she did what we had talked about in the drill, you know, bum in the air, head on the ground, but of course in the hospital cafeteria, that is a really weird thing to see someone do. And the porters that were around to help her back to the ward had no idea what was happening. So it was just a really tricky situation. But all was well, and she had a cesarean section, and the cord was not in any way prolapsed. You know, things can also happen in the hospital unless you stay close to the ward. You know, it's not necessarily all that much easier than calling the ambulance and getting there quickly. But yeah, there's things that happen, you know, in isolation of the reason that you were in the hospital for. You know, you will also be institutionalized and have lots of other things happen to you that might not be to your liking, and you can decline all those too. You know, you can just, you know, sleep in the hospital and do your thing without accepting any of the other stuff that you know, you wouldn't be doing at home necessarily. Doing the same things. So yeah, there's always ways to you know, choose pathways in ways that make sense to you. You don't always have to choose the whole package. You can decline bits of the package that's offered to you, and that's not always going to be acceptable to the healthcare professionals caring for you, but their happiness is not your concern or not your responsibility. So, you know, you look out for yourself and your baby and for no one else, I guess. But, you know, again, that's hard. It's easier said than done, isn't it?
I think it's something that a lot of people struggle with, is, you know, those just advocating for yourself when you're pregnant. I think it's really hard, really, really, really hard. But I think the first step is knowing that you can, and understanding how to. And I think knowing, you know, listening to the, you know, discussions like this and being aware of things helps with that, because then you know what questions to ask, you know what the options are, you're a little bit better informed, and therefore it makes it a little bit easier, I think, to advocate for yourself.
I think so. I think it's always really helpful to just, you know, when you're having a consultation with a healthcare professional, just right at the start, say what is acceptable to you and what isn't. Just lay your ground rules. You know, and then at least the healthcare professional knows where you're coming from. Because oftentimes, if you're not sure about what you want and what you're willing to accept and what you're not willing to accept, and you sort of seem unsure about what you want, it's almost like an invitation to shape your decision making into something that that particular healthcare professional would like you to do. And if someone's not sure, then as a healthcare professional, we have, I guess, little option but to present them with the guidelines and general protocols that we would generally need to recommend. But if someone has very clear boundaries from the start, it's much easier to shape an individualized care plan for them, I think. I find that a lot easier anyway. It's quite hard to help someone who doesn't know what they want, other than to just to give them all the options. And then they can, but if you don't know what you want, then that's quite tricky too. I think about what you want and then lay out the ground rules really soon, and very clearly, and I think then it's a lot easier to get support.
I think this has been such a helpful, I feel like we've gone from nuchal cords to cord prolapse to advocacy and birth planning. I think it's all part and parcel of the same discussion, really, isn't it?
We haven't talked about nuchal cords actually very much.
I know we did. Well, I think the top line is it's actually not an emergency.
It's not a problem. But generally, if it is going to be a problem, there's going to be symptoms of that problem. That we would act on regardless of whether it was due to a cord or not. And so it's sort of a bit of a no-brainer.
So hopefully it reassures, because I think it is something that people worry about.
Oh,
100%. And hopefully this reassures them that actually it's not, you know, it's not as big an issue as I think people think it is or make out
it.
And it's as scary as a cord prolapse is, it's actually very, very rare.
Very rare, but that is an issue if it happens.
So just remind people, where can they find you if they want to follow you and read all of the wonderful stuff that you post up?
So I have an Instagram that's at Debsagos. Don't ask me why I've got that name. I don't even know anymore. myself. Anyway, but that's me on Instagram, Debsagos. And then I'm just Debs Nyga on Facebook. And I also have a website, and that's www.debsnygaindependentwife.co.uk. And that's where I can be found generally.
Amazing.
Thinking about several, many different pregnancy, birthy, postnatal groups, and all sorts of corners of the internet. So
what area do you cover for your independent midwife?
So I'm based in York, but I cover the whole of Yorkshire up to Newcastle, down to Grantham, and then also west and east from me. So I cover a really, really big area. What can I say? I quite like to drive. So
I'm sadly not down south.
not that far, I don't think.
Thank you so much for your time today. It's been amazing chatting to you. I'm sure I'm going to try and persuade you to come back on again at some point and talk about something else, because I just like chatting. Yeah. Thanks, Jess.
Well, no worries.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.